something, a sound or anything, there is an imagination that comes in our mind. There is a picture. For example, when the door, the bell rings, you know that there is someone outside. When someone knocks the door, when you hear the sound of knocking the door, mm-hmm. you imagine that there is someone out there, because this imagination takes you through a process which goes towards the cause and effect.
Right.
To the process of cause and effect, because if this effect has happened, there was a cause mm-hmm. behind it.
Yes.
So it takes you there. So everything we can say, like, it is based on the imagination. We cannot think of anything which is out of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot delete this thing. So if they are saying, like, the imagination is the root for the ethics, imagination is the root for the rest of the things as well.
And what about imagination and sympathy, Brother Yasser? Since you, in the last part of your words, you referred to the fact that you define imagination not in a philosophical sense, but in this simple term, that you say that you imagine to be in the shoes of somebody else. Like, for example, when we are advised, when we are recommended to fast, some people, some ethicists say that this is because God wants you to, like, to let you feel the hunger that is, like, in the stomach of the poor. This is one of the reasons, obviously, of mm-hmm. course. There are many things to it, but one of the reasons being this. Would you think that there is this kind of relationship between imagination and ethics here, and also sympathy?
I think there can be, because if an individual, as we say in English, put yourself in another person's shoes, this is something we always say, you know, what were you in that person's shoes?
Yes, and how would you do?
How would you act? How would you react? Yeah. And so on. So it can be, again, it depends on how the person is. The question is asked, will it actually have a result after it?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. Obviously, tests and stuff need to be done on it. The example you gave of fasting, for example, it is not that example itself is very profound, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't just tell you to imagine it, He tells you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually feel it.
Yes.
Hence, the actual, for example, a person who imagines a poor person compared to a person who's actually taken to, for example, a refugee camp,
yeah,
wherever, the effect is going to be far greater for that person who physically sees, you know, and creates, doesn't need to imagine, because imagination has that thing. Yes, you have pictures, but that pictures do not give you the effects of the actual physical reality in the outside world at times.
Mother Teresa says a helping hand is much better than a praying mouth.
Again, but there is a fallacy in that as well.
Yes.
But yes, obviously.
But there is truth to it.
No, exactly. In context, that saying is true. For example, you have a person who has the ability to physically go and help.
Mm-hmm.
And he decides not to help and stay at home. That's different. But a person who has nothing to help, but he says that I will pray for you. The dua of the second person is far greater than
yes,
the first one.
Of course.
It depends on context.
No, it doesn't define.
It's in the Quran
fact.
As well. Qawlun ma'ruf.
Ma'ruf, yeah. So, qawlun la'in.
Yeah, this statement doesn't defy supplication and prayer.
No, it doesn't define it. It doesn't define it, nor does it negate it.
Yeah.
But my thing is that, yes, imagination has may be a starter, but it does not have the effect and will never have the effect of actually going to a place to assist. Going,
yes.
for example, to refugee camps. Going to squatter camps,
yes.
going and helping orphans, going to the orphanage.
Basically, actions that speak louder
exactly.
than words.
Exactly. You see it in real life.
Yeah.
I mean, if that was the case, then, you know, Allah would say for 1 month every day, just imagine that you're not eating and you're not drinking. Or while you're having your tea, imagine that, you know, your stomach is sore. The actual physical feelings and emotions, well, even that, like when you see something, the emotions in a person, you know, start more.
Mm-hmm.
It's more affected. Even then, for example, dreams, for example.
Yes.
Dreams are also pictures, imagination. But if you dream about something compared to imagining something, the effect in the dream is more, because there's a distinct physical nature to dreams. Even now, psychologists themselves completely do not understand what dreams are.
Exactly. That's a black box.
Right? They don't want to go into that discussion, because they will fall into, with their understanding of what the soul is, will fall into a quagmire and not come out of it.
Exactly.
So they don't go to dreams, but the difference between their imagination...
They're working, they're experimenting on dreams, but not in the sense that we talk
exactly.
about. Like they
basically...
They will
talk about dreams, about the mental functions of
exactly.
it, what part of the brain happens. What is a dream? They will never be able to understand it, because... that imagination in a dream compared to me now sitting imagining myself in a particular island, I will feel something in that dream. Many of us are telling when you in the dream, when you feel you're falling, you actually wake up when your heart is pounding. But now if I imagine I'm falling down a mountain, nothing happens to me. Why?
Right.
There's a difference.
Yes.
So, yes, imagination may play a role, but it will never come to the actual physical being and helping and seeing it with your own physical eyes. So that's my opinion, that yes, it might not even have an effect afterwards on a person.
But the Mother Teresa, what she said, when we look at the Quran, I was about to mention the verse as well. It is said, قَوْلٌ مَعْرُوفٌ خَيْرٌ مِّن صَدَقَةٍ يَتْبَعُهَا أَذًا. It is said that the good speech is better than a charity that you give that harms, or you can say like it hurts people.
Yes.
You know, today we can see there are many people who are helping people. Or
as a matter of show-off, you mean?
Yes, as a matter of show-off, or maybe, you know, they do not show off at that time, but they help in a way that the person who's receiving that charity, he feels...
would be demeaning.
Humiliated by the person, or maybe amongst the people when you're... Well, you know, today when these charity companies or the NGOs, they're helping, they're making videos,
nowadays.
All those things, and then they bring the pictures of these kids. No matter what they feel, how they feel about these things. So there are different, obviously, ways to do that. If we go Quranic, if we go through the Quranic way, there are different things. About the sympathy, obviously, there are different meanings of that. Mm-hmm. One of the meanings is believing in something, believing in a plan or an action. So if we want to relate this imagination with this type of sympathy, sympathy with... that is fine. But obviously when we say sympathy for, that has another meaning.
Yes.
That you feel sympathy for a child or a poor person. So we need to, again, go back to the definitions.
And we also have the idea and the concept, which is more important than sympathy, that is empathy.
Empathy.
Which goes deeper than the sympathy. Basically, it's what urges you to act on it.
On it.
Rather than just to say something.
And that cannot be done without imagination. But imagination does not solely depend on this. Because sometimes you can imagine something and do not have any reaction on it. You're just imagining. And there is a famous quotation from Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. He says, imagination is like a bird. If you leave it, it will fly wherever it wants. So you need to control it.
I see.
So when we are talking about the imagination, especially they
but
say
how
like
to control
how to,
it is also important, isn't it?
They say like we need to teach our kids how to imagine things or how to do the imagination. There should be a limit. There are the limits. You need to be live within the limits. And if you leave it, for example, if we want to think about a person, we can go... or we can think about all the aspects, imagine all the aspects of that person.
I see.
But obviously, within the Sharia, within the Islam, you need to limit this imagination. Two people were fighting to each other, and they had a discussion, and when I went home, I was thinking about them. My imagination took me to a place where I was thinking, imagining where one has killed the other one. So basically, these imaginations, they should be controlled. And we need to control this. That's why Imam Ali said, you need to control it, because if you leave it, it will fly anywhere it wants.
Thank you very much, Brother Ali Mohsen and Brother Yasser, in helping us in this episode of the program Back to Reality to talk about the relationship between imagination, sympathy, and ethics. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again. يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair.
So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
It's 3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those angles, if you could briefly mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It was very refreshing to see you.
Yeah, very much so. Very
and
much.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I was shot at in my car with a machine gun." And then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day. Not left to being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this." And so began the Intifada.
But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. And you know, I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually, for a long time, the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to, you know, communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary, you also see lots of statistics. Filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized that it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000. So that the actually the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayad Waglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But, of course, we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is... I think in this documentary, it's absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
Mm. And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of you know, all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realise the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behave in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films. You can see that this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director. Probably wasn't quite as veteran when he first started shooting all this and then when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the U.S. government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world, and the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel lobby in the United States, and the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so, and if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how these Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yeah.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language, how you describe things. It's, as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is, who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed, except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story and we have failed and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Whatever Fatima did was for Ali. Especially from the wafat of Rasulullah to her last day. Whether she spoke for Ali. If she was silent, she was silent for Ali. If she was happy, she was happy for Ali. And if she was sad, she was sad for Ali. And that is something, you know, we have to keep in mind that these are the issues that even she mentions in a different way in the khutbah that she talks about the Prophet and then Ali. Let me now talk about her. Even when we use this term, Alayhi salam. Alayhi salam is the masculine form. Alayhi salam is the feminine form. On her be peace. Even there, you know, we are not exaggerating. And this is actually the the customary way of talking about Ali and Fatima, even during the early days. If you look at Sahih Bukhari. Even the print which exists now with the English translation by Dr. Mohsin Khan, and this is published with the approval of the Saudi, I think, Medina University, And so there are the Arabic, the actual script and the English translation on the side. And even if you look at that, and I actually gone through it, wherever Fatima's name has been mentioned, it's interesting that Bukhari, even in the version which exists now, you know, because we hear quite a lot that people, you know, they are changing the text of the Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, but they haven't done, at least on this issue. If you see the name of Ali, the name of Hassan, the name of Hussein, even the name of Ali Zainul Abidin in Sahih Bukhari, you will see that Bukhari uses the word alayhi salam after their names. Not only Ali, Hassan and Hussein and even Ali, Zainul Abidin, he says alayhi salam. When it comes to Fatima al-Zahra salawatullah alayha, he mentions her 26 times in Sahih Bukhari. And in every case, he uses the term alayha salam for her. Very interesting. Sometimes you might want to see the contrast. And this is Sahih Bukhari. It's not Usul al-Kafi of the Shias. You know, in the section on Farzul al-Khums, the obligation of Khums, there is a chapter in Sahih Bukhari about it. You know, it's not that the Sunnis only talk about zakat. They've forgotten about khums, but it is part of their religious teachings also. So there is a section on the obligation of khums. There, you know, he goes through his own chain of narrations all the way to Urwa bin al-Zubayr, where he says, and I'm using the actual words there, "Anna Aisha Umm al-Mu'mineen radiyallahu anha." Pay attention to the honorary words he uses after the names. He says, "Anna Aisha Umm al-Mu'mineen radiyallahu anha akhbarathu." She informed this fellow, Urba bin Zubayr. What did she say? She said, "Anna Fatima alayha salam ibnatu Rasulillah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam." The same line. When it comes to the name of Aisha, Imam Bukhari is using the word radiyallahu anha. Just two words after that, when he mentions the name of Fatima, he says alayha salam, and this is actually a quotation from Aisha. The daughter of Rasulullah sa'alat Aba Bakr as-Siddiq ba'da wafati Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam an yuqassim laha mirathaha. And she says that, you know, the daughter of the Prophet asked Abu Bakr after the passing away of the Prophet to divide the inheritance of the father, mimma taraka Rasulullah, mimma afa' Allah alayhi. Whatever Allah had given to him, you know, now it's time to divide that. فَقَالَ لَهُ أَبُو بَكْرُ. This is where Abu Bakr says, إِنَّ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمُ. This is where he's quoting this statement, which Fatima never heard from her father. Ali doesn't know anything about it. And he is Baba Madinatil Ilm, where he says that, you know, whatever ma tarakna sadaqa. The Prophet said that whatever we leave behind doesn't become part of the inheritance, it is charity. فَغَضِبَتْ فَاطِمَا بِنْتَ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمْ فَهَجَرَتْ أَبَا بَكْرَ فَلَمْ تَزِلْ مُهَاجَرَتُهُ حَتَّى تُوَفِّيَتْ. And this is where, you know, the issue that, you know, she became very angry with Abu Bakr and continued her anger until she passed away. The point here is that in the same line, when it comes to the name of Fatima al-Zahra, Bukhari mentions alayha salam. And this is where we have to realize that if you're really talking about going back to the original Islam, in the sense of Islam of the early days, then you have to give the honor and respect which is due to the Ahlul Bayt. And don't be swayed by those who claim to be the followers of As-Salaf al-Salih. Those who call themselves that we are the followers of the righteous ancestors, referring to the first generation of the Muslims, and therefore they call themselves Salafis. What they are doing actually has nothing to do with Salaf. These are all bid'ah And this is all innovation where they have degraded the status of the Ahlul Bayt in their own language and the conversation and the writing that they have. What can you do when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran, in Surah Al Imran, ayah 33, he himself says, Inna Allah astafa, istafa, to choose, to select. This is where we have the name Al Mustafa, Muhammad the chosen one. Inna Allah astafa, salawat par nikbara. Verily Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen Adam wa Nuhan. Among the creation, he selected the human beings, the first one being Adam. Then he mentions the name of Nuh, because he is the one where the humanity continued after Adam. And then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't go through individual names and summarizes by saying, Wa'ala Ibrahim. And Allah chose the family of Ibrahim wa'ala Imran. Ala Imran could be both the family of Maryam as well as the family of Abu Talib. Ala al-alamin, over the whole world. If Allah has chosen them over the whole world and given them that status, who are we to degrade them? And so this is nothing ghulu, there is no exaggeration. We are following what the Quran has taught us. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala give us the tawfiq to be the among true followers on a practical level of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked as
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
وقتی حادثه قدیر پیش آمد، مرحوم تبرسی در مجمع البیان دارد، مرحوم علامه امینی هم در القدیر دارد.
Both the late Tabarsi in the book Majma' al-Bayan and Allama Amin in the book Al-Ghadir narrates that when the event of Ghadir took place, a person by the name of Nu'man ibn Haris came to Prophet Muhammad and said, O Prophet of Allah, why have you selected Ali as your successor? If it is your personal decision, I do not accept it. However, if it is Allah's decision, I cannot bear such a decision. Then he said, I'm ready to die, but do not see Ali as your successor. Now, some say that Surah Al-Mi'raj was revealed over here. Nu'man ibn Haris was ready to accept Allah's chastisement, but not Allah's order. It is narrated that he was chastised by a stone and died on that moment. This is where the haste of a human in getting the answer to his request will become an ill wish and perishes him. Now, dear brothers and sisters, we are asked in the narrations to have tasabbut or preciseness and deep thinking. Before our good wishes are changed to ill ones, we have to ponder more and do not hasten in getting the answers to all our requests. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out more about this program and our other programs, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye. Thank you.
next month.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland, and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it's obviously the system is not working. A political system hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy, and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest poll shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th during an inauguration ceremony that wasn't attended by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The reason for that absence was made clear just hours after, when Biden signed over a dozen executive orders reversing policies adopted by the previous U.S. administration. The Biden administration says it will roll back Trump's policies that are harmful to Americans and to the rest of the world. The new president signed an order lifting the so-called Muslim ban. The U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement on climate change and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has also taken action on the COVID-19 pandemic and signed an executive order to rejoin the World Health Organization. Absent from the announced Biden 100-day program, however, is any proposed reversals of Israel policies implemented by the Trump administration that risk security concerns of a global scale, including moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel, U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel, U.S. support for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, and the assassination of foreign figures.
Anything you want to do in the United States as president or Congress or almost any part of government, you need Israeli permission. You know, Israel is the one that allows you to do things and puts a veto on anything they don't like. It's very unusual for the United States to do something that Israel doesn't like. And in this case, Israel doesn't want to reverse any of these policies.
In his confirmation session in the Senate, Biden's pick for Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stresses support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem. But he remained silent on the many concessions made to the Tel Aviv during the Trump administration, leading Israel to believe that the new administration's policies won't differ much from that of the former president. In the first volume of his presidential memoir, A Promised Land, Barack Obama writes about the pressure exerted from Israeli lobbies. He wrote that American politicians who criticized Israel policy too loudly risk being tagged as anti-Israel and possibly anti-Semitic and were confronted with a well-funded opponent in the next election. He added that Israel's supporters in the U.S. use accusations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of the regime's policies against the Palestinians. The former U.S. president further hit out at the pro-Israeli lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, saying that the group moved to the right ideologically to mirror Netanyahu's administration and defended Israel even when its actions were contrary to U.S. policy. Obama also wrote that while congressional Republicans did not care about Palestinians' rights, their Democratic counterparts were, quote, worried about angering AIPAC and losing its support. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he opposes West Bank settlements construction in line with an international consensus that Israeli structures in the occupied Palestinian lands violate international law. He has further vowed to return to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump abandoned in May 2018. In such a political climate, as described in Obama's memoir, Biden will be fighting an uphill battle should he decide to overturn any of Trump's policies on Israel.
Frankly, I think that Biden is afraid of trying to reverse any of these. And why take a chance? Israel's happy with it, just leave it alone. That's the way he looks at it.
Only time will tell whether Biden, who faces numerous challenges both from the inside and abroad, would choose to risk his political career, which culminated in his presidency, by going against Israel's agenda.